when we have fish women on the street that sell fish, they sell flowers, they sell fruit, they sell all kinds of stuff. And the two women on the street, and one says to the other one, "She told me she's either got a cold or she's expecting." And the woman says, the other woman says to her, "I wonder who gave her a cold." So that kind of thing is that it's, or one lady says to the other one, she says, "You know, I'd love to be a man." And the other one says, "Why?" And she says, "Well, then I wouldn't have to kiss someone who hasn't shaved or washed for 3 days." So things like that, you know, are, you know, the thing about it is that in Dublin, we're surrounded by history and by the places where these literary people that you've heard about, like W.B. Yeats and James Joyce, people like that have lived. And this gentleman seems to enjoy in the shower here. The thing about it is that we, as a rule, I think we forget about where we live. And I remember growing up in Dublin, in around the Kelly's Corner area of Dublin, and we used to tie kids up outside on the lamppost and ring the doorbell and run away. And when the owner of the house came out, of course, he beat the kid up or whatever. But I remember in thinking back now, some of the houses that we tied kids up outside the doors, one of them was Bram Stoker's house, who, of course, wrote Dracula. And George Bernard Shaw, he lived in 3 Sing Street, where I actually lived around the corner from that. And these were lovely areas that they were old areas. They'd been there probably for over 150, 200 years. And the nice thing about Dublin is that when I was president of the Irish Club in Jacksonville, one of the fellas there used to give me a hard time about it all the time. He used to say to me, "Where were you born?" And I said, "I was born in Ennis." And he says, "Yeah, but you're a dub." And it used to really get my goat. It used to really annoy me, the fact that this fella would say to me, you know, "You're from Dublin." And then in 1988, Dublin turned 1,000 years old. And I thought to myself, it's not too bad to be from a place that's 1,000 years old, because Ennis, where I was born, was 750 years old. So I actually, Dublin is 250 years older in 1988. But the American writer Virginia Woolf said that Ireland's a lovely place, but they talk too much. And I'm glad to say that I feel really Irish in that respect. My wife doesn't say I talk too much. She says I talk a lot, which is probably a more tactful to say, a tactful way of saying that. But, you know, another thing was Sir John Pentland Mahaffey. He said that nothing unexpected in Ireland, inevitable never happens, he says. The inevitable never happens. But he says that the one thing you can really depend on is that the unexpected constantly occurs. And I like to think that keeps us at least interesting, Irish people interesting, in that when you walk through Dublin, you're surrounded by the history of the place. And when you walk through any part of Ireland, in fact, and I remember we brought a tour of people back to Ireland 3 years ago, and we were standing in the church, in one of the churches, I should say, that's open to the sky now in Clonmacnoise, which was built around the 7th century. And I remember saying to a fella who was on the tour with me, I said, "Do you feel at home here?" And he was an American who had come over to find his roots. And he says, I really do, William. He says, "I really feel at home here." And I said, "Well, that's good, because if you look at your feet, you're standing on one of your relatives, because all the flagstones in the church were of people that had been buried in the church, and the actual flagstone he was standing on was one of his relatives." So it was really amazing to see him break down in tears, because Ireland, even though I'm from there, brings me close to tears every time I think of it, because there's such wonderful things that you experience. And I remember an American girl once said to me that she was walking through a forest in Ireland and she didn't feel at home. she felt that, you know, like here in America, she felt like she really was at home in that she wasn't afraid, she wasn't lonely. She felt that she was surrounded by the spirits that had gone before in the forest. And, you know, if you think about it, most forests that you walk through, you may possibly be the first person to ever walk through that place. So I know I'm rambling, but I'll eventually come back to you. You know, that's one thing about this, about talking about things. I was thinking also about Samuel Beckett, one of our probably most famous of all the people in literature. And Samuel Beckett was another mixed-up individual in that he left Ireland to go to France. And he taught taught French, actually, when he came back in Trinity College. And then he left again to go and be a secretary to James Joyce in France. And, I mean, if that's not mixed up, I don't know what is. But while he was in France, he got involved with the French resistance and, you know, joined in the Second World War and then came back to Ireland and helped set up the Irish Red Cross. So we're like contradictions in terms. And I think that that's another nice thing about, you know, they say that, well, Ireland, we seem to be a nation of travelers. You know, once young fellas get to about 18 or 19 years of age, the first thing they do is they leave the country. And for many, many years there, we had what we call a brain drain, because all the kids who were coming out of high school and college were just leaving and going to America, going to England. And now, you know, since the past 10 or 12 years, we have this, the onslaught of what they call the Celtic Tiger. And the actual whole face of Ireland, I think, has changed. In going back to Ireland 3 years ago, I noticed huge changes. One of the things I noticed was that as we were standing outside one of the hotels waiting for a friend of ours to come and pick us up, I had been in this particular spot many, many times in the past and was very nervous in this particular spot because it was a dangerous part of Dublin when I left it. And now there was this incredibly beautiful hotel there and we were staying there on like the fifth or eighth floor or whatever it was. But I had this beautiful Nikon camera with me and I thought to myself, I'm standing here out in the middle of the street with a Nikon camera. So I wrapped it around my leg and stood with the bag at my feet and I thought, well, if somebody comes along and tries to get the camera off me, they're going to have to knock me down first. And then, as I turned around, I noticed the most brilliant photo opportunity, and of course my camera was at my feet, so it was over with. But five girls were walking around the corner, one of them pushing a little baby in a stroller, and they were all on cell phones. And then I really knew that things had changed, that we were coming into line with the rest of the place. In actual fact, in Dublin, it's extremely hard to find a call box on the street because now everybody, literally almost everybody, has a cell phone. And Ennis, where I was born in County Clare, in about 1991 or 92, Ennis became one of the EU cities. And they decided that there's so many computer companies and everything moving into the Shannon Development Centres and places like that, Wang and CompUSA and all these huge computer companies moving in. And one of the computer companies decided that they picked on Ennis and they decided that they would give everybody in Ennis a computer. So these fellas who couldn't even write their name, that all of a sudden they had a computer and they were on the internet and they had their own web pages and everything. So it is a country of anomalies. Lovely things, lovely stories come to mind. One of, say, for example, Brendan Behan. I always think of Brendan Behan walking through Anglesey Road, which is a lovely area of Dublin, all these Georgian houses and everything like that. And I'm walking down the street, and of course, Brendan was a great smoker and drinker. And he was a great wit also. But as he's walking down the road, he was always in trouble too, because unfortunately of drink, you know, there's a thing. But as he's walking down the road and he's enjoying the morning air, if you like, he got up and he thought, I'll go for a walk. As he's walking down the road, we have these double-decker buses in the old days. And the double-decker buses, you'd got on at the back of the bus. It was an open-end bus. And as you got on at the back of the bus, you had a bar there. There was no door or anything. You just pulled yourself on, got in downstairs, or you walked up the stairs to the upstairs where you could smoke. But anyway, this bus overtook Brendan Behan as he's walking down the road and, as I said, enjoying the air and everything like that. And the women in the 40s, 50s, 60s, they used to wear these black, almost like, it looked to me like, when I was growing up as a kid, like witches' costumes almost, because they had a scarf on as well. And sometimes they'd be young women, sometimes they'd be grandmothers or whatever. But this lady got off the bus, and as she turned around, Brendan Behan noticed that this woman, all in black, her breast was exposed. And he said, oh, my God, missus, he says, would you ever make yourself decent? And she looked down, saw her breast exposed, and said, jeez, I'm after leaving the baby on the bus. So this is the kind of thing. The one thing about Dublin people is they're never at a want for words. And that's the thing that I like about it. I'm standing here in front of five people. But the thing about it is, it's hard to shut me up. But when the time comes up, you just wave or throw something at me, I'll shut up. But the thing about these women also is that, as I said at the start of this, that a lot of them sold fish or flowers or fruit or whatever it happened to be on a place called Moore Street in Dublin. And I remember one of the things was this American walked up and he says to the woman behind the stall, he says, hello, ma'am, I'm here from America. It's very nice to meet you. And she says, very nice to meet you too, sir. Very nice to meet you. He says, they're oranges, I believe. And she says, yes, sir, they are definitely, they're lovely oranges, lovely ripe oranges. And he says, and how much are those oranges? And she says, well, they're a pound for a dozen, sir. And he says, well, I believe I'll take a dozen of them. And she says, thank you very much, sir. And he's getting his money out, and she gets a paper bag, and she's putting the oranges in. And she hands it to him, and he hands her the pound. And he says, thank you very much, ma'am. Have a very pleasant day. And he walks away, and she says, thank you very much, sir. Goodbye now. And off he goes. And he thinks to himself, after hearing stories about all these women, how they're very clever and all this, just for argument's sake, he says, now, I was watching her. I think I was watching her. But he says, there's an empty cart here. Let me turf out the oranges here and have a look and see, did I get what I paid for? So he counts them out anyway, and he looks, and he says, there's only 11 oranges here. So he puts them back in the bag, and he goes back to the woman, and he says to her, excuse me, ma'am, do you remember me? Yeah, indeed, and I do, sir. She says, yes, I do, indeed. And he says, I'm the American, you remember, that bought those dozen oranges off you a couple of minutes ago? Yes, sir, I do, indeed. And he says, well, ma'am, over in America, you know, a dozen is still 12. Oh, indeed. And she says, "In here in Ireland it is as well, sir." And he says, well, I don't want to have an argument with you or anything. He says, but I counted out these oranges here, and I'll do it again for you, ma'am. There's only 11 here. And she says, I know that, sir, she says. One of them was bad, and I'd thrown it away for you. So the thing about it is that they were also, these people were, they're still there to this day, in fact, but because of the surrounds, all the old buildings for a little while there, we had many Georgian houses that had been built in the 1700s and the 1800s that were exquisite. In fact, they had Italian artisans come over and do the ceilings, the plaster work in the ceilings. And some of them were so beautiful and intricate, are actually seen nowhere else in the world. And the corporation or the city council were knocking down all these beautiful houses. And one of the priests, the Catholic priests, And you hear a lot of bad things about Catholic priests and stuff like that, now. But the thing about it is that a lot of the priests were very, very involved in the communities. And this particular priest decided this can't happen and came out and stood in front of the bulldozers and told the corporation and the city, you can't be smashing down these buildings. Now there are preservation orders on these buildings only because of people like that that came and took an interest. Another thing is that Dublin was named because of the fact that the Vikings came up the river, and where Trinity College now is, in fact, was a big pool. And the Liffey, as it's known, the river that runs through Dublin, that actually came into a big pool there. So the Gaelic word for pool, for black pool, because it was very dark and very deep, is Dublin. So Dublin actually gets its name from the Gaelic words Dublin, black pool. And now there is a huge pair of buildings that look to me like, look like, for all the world, like a Viking helmet or something like that. And they're on the Liffey, right on the quays there. But a lot of younger people don't realize why these buildings are there and how they came to be, and the fight to actually get them there by the Bank of Ireland, I think it was. In the 70s, the Viking remains, the settlements of the first Vikings, were found on these, on the quays, as we call them, on the banks of the Liffey. And the Liffey runs, it separates the two halves of Dublin, if you like, the south and the north. And if you're from the south side, usually they say that you're from the better side of Dublin. If you're from the north side, it's from the working class or whatever. But people in Dublin on the south side still haven't figured out how to give up work, and we all work in Dublin. But the thing about it was that they were just building, came in, knocked down the buildings that were there, and started to excavate the site to put down these huge foundations. And after a couple of weeks, they started to find these Viking remains. Well, again, somebody in the community went to one of the local priests, I think his name was Father Matthews, and said to him, there's Viking remains there and they're just building. Well, he actually came out and chained himself to one of the bulldozers and stopped them from doing the work until they could excavate the site a little bit. And then they found out, yes, that these were definitely the remains of the first Vikings that had come to Dublin. And the city of Dublin, in its wisdom, gave them a stay of execution, if you like, because they stopped the building for 6 months so that they could excavate the site, with a kind of an addendum to it, that if these buildings, after they were built, ever fell down, then they could excavate the site in whole. So these buildings, when I looked at them there when I was back 3 years ago and realized these things are never going away, a lot of the stuff around Dublin has been lost through just people coming in. And there was, I think, a lot of corruption in the 50s and 60s where ministers or senators, you'd call them here, I suppose, or councillors were paid off to turn a blind eye to these things. So thankfully, a lot of that has stopped. But as I said, one of the main things in Dublin is that we see humour in situations. And one of my favourite things there that I read the other day, these two, as I said again, these Moor Street women, and they're talking all the time about their husbands and their boyfriends and all that. So, and to see a lot of these women, a lot of them very overweight, and they eat all day long. They've got these huge carts full of fruit and nuts and you name it. They sell anything. And especially at Halloween, one of the nightmares for a little kid was that they had these huge old overcoats on, because, you know, one of the things about the weather in Ireland is, you know, even in Ireland we have 365 days in the year, you know, and 150 days it rains. 150 days. And you have these people say, oh, the weather was beautiful, the sun was out for weeks, you know, and you just wonder, you know, at what at what stage of the year was that? Because any time you go there, and as I said, 3 years ago, we brought a tour back. We'd get on the bus. We'd drive from Galway City, say, to the Cliffs of Moher in Clare. And as we're driving, the rain is lashing down. As we get to the Cliffs of Moher, the door of the bus opens. The sun comes out. We get up, we walk around the Cliffs of Moher for about 2.5 hours. We get back on the bus and it lashes rain all the way back to Galway. So I think that's actually the way the weather works in Ireland. You know, I think you know, they say that God blessed Ireland. And I think that's one of the ways he does it, because he doesn't make life totally miserable. I think, too, that talking about these old ladies from Moor Street and that, one of them says... She says, I was talking to me husband last night, and he says to me, do you know the facts of life at all? And she says, I do, but I don't like them. But one of the things is that, you know, as I said, you get off the plane in Dublin, and you drive in, and you see for about 30 minutes, you see all this new developments and stuff like that. But if you look closer in any of the streets, it's amazing to see that these houses, like I say, you know, James Joyce, for example, James Joyce is one of our most famous writers. And yet he left Dublin when he was 22 years old, because he was always in arguments and everything like that with everybody. And nobody actually really, I don't think, liked James Joyce. Of course, then when he wrote Ulysses and he wrote Dubliners, Dubliners, in fact, is probably almost undecipherable. Ulysses, a lot of people have a go at, and, you know, it's a great, how would you say, like a proving ground for someone who says there's they have a master's in like literature or something like that, because it's a little bit of a puzzle. But Dubliners, the other book, is totally undecipherable. But as I said, Samuel Beckett went to work for him as his secretary. So that's why you have books like Waiting for Godot from Beckett. But I don't want to forget anything I wanted to say to you. So my notes. I made a couple of notes, too, that one of the things I remember, too, in 1963, I believe it was, JFK came over to Galway, and we happened to be, my grandmother and grandfather had come over from Wales and started what we called a carnival. And we were very lucky to be near Galway at the time, and we heard that John F. Kennedy was coming to Galway. Of course, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of Galway. And one thing I remember, I was about seven at the time, and we were on a railings overlooking all this stuff. And he got out of the car and walked over to the railings and patted each one of us kids on the head. And I always remember John F. Kennedy saying that one of the most pleasurable things that he could think of in life was to drive through Ireland and just wave at people. And he says, I might just go back and do it. So I think a lot of the times is that even with the Iraqi situation here, Ireland has always seemed to stay neutral. And yet, there really wouldn't be an Ireland without America, because Ireland has always been supported by America. And America, of course, is always supported, even though we probably, the governments and that don't say that they'll go to war and whatever. But you always find that the majority of fellas like in the wars happen to be from Ireland. Some of the things I've discovered in the 17 or 18 years since I've been here is that, for example, when I was a kid, I loved George Armstrong Custer, General George Armstrong Custer. Then you come over here and you find out that maybe there were things that he did that were not very good, and then you find out that he was actually a bit of a villain. Then you find out, when you look at the graveyard around Little Bighorn, you find out that most of the lads that were killed were Irish fellas. And that's shocking to me. Also, there's been many movies, or many films, as we call them in Ireland, that have come out of late, like Mel Gibson's We Were Soldiers. And a lot of the fellas that were killed there were Irish soldiers also. So one of my friends, in actual fact, many, many years ago when I was growing up in Ireland, and my grandmother had taught us, because we were on the road all the time, we were traveling around with our carnival, and she taught me to read. But one of the lads that encouraged me to read was a young fella called Michael Hallion. And Michael left to come to the United States. And when he got off the plane here, he, of course, was trying to apply for citizenship. And they told him, well, you know, if you join the army, you get your citizenship within about 3 months. So he did that. He went to Vietnam and he was killed in the first week he was there. So it's stuff like that that brings us together, I think. And, of course, the other thing would be the music of Ireland. I'm very lucky, in fact, that one of the things that keeps me sane every week is I have a radio program in St. Augustine called Irish Ways that I do on Flagler College Radio. And if I didn't do that, I think I'd lose my mind, because I think the thing about America is that it separates us by distance. And even, you know, you have a sister that lives in Palatka and you live in, you know, Charleston or somewhere like that. And it's distance that separates us. Yes, we have telephones. Yes, we have email and all this kind of stuff. But as my good friend, one of my good friends, Claire Roach, who comes here to the festival, she said to me many years ago, she's a harper from Ireland, that when I brought the chieftains here to Jacksonville, the first time they were ever actually in Florida, I'm glad to say, and Claire opened for them. And when the internet first came out and we all started to get on, and I held out for a long time, she says to me, isn't email very cold? And it is, because you can lose friends. You know, Dale Carnegie should have written another book on the internet, How to Lose Friends and, you know, influence people wrongly, because of course it in a lot of respects it's brought us closer together. But as regards, now they're starting to get these things that, you know, when you ask a question, you have this sidebar almost that press on it and it puts up a little cheery, happy face and stuff like that, or claps or something like that with a little hand clap on the side. So a lot of the times I think that the only thing, of course, that keeps us together is stuff like this. And I'm delighted to have been coming here for, well, the past 15 years, actually. I've been coming here to the folk festival here. And I'm also a jeweler and make Irish jewelry and stuff like that. And I've done exhibitions of Irish jewelry here. And in looking back into it and making Irish jewelry in Ireland and stuff like that, and then you come back here and you start to discover that so much of the stuff that you just took for granted around you is actually means quite a lot more than it meant to you over in Ireland. You know, for example, I carved Celtic crosses, and on the bottom of a Celtic cross, you know, you've got the, like a triumvirate kind of sign on the bottom. That's the Trinity, that actual sign on the bottom of a Celtic cross that you see that has three little, almost like oval shapes on the bottom, is the Trinity. So it's been a wonderful experience living here in America. And I know I've rambled on a bit because, you know, you always get nervous on your first day here, but it's a joy to come and talk about Ireland. But I would also like to shut up and ask you if you had any questions. Does anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask about Ireland? No, everybody knows everything about it now? Because I don't. I always find that, you know, the people said, isn't it lovely that the English now have the Channel? And, you know, it's probably one of the worst things that they ever did, because they've taken away their island status. And I hope that Ireland never does that, because we, I think, while we're surrounded by water, I think it's important that you keep your independence. And now with the euro, which is the in 1972 or 1973, we went decimal. And that was, I think, the worst thing we could ever have done. Now we've gone to the euro, where it means you can spend the same money in any country. But I don't think that's really the case, is that you're still spending what you think is the same money, but you're actually being gazumped on a lot of the prices and stuff like that. So I think that we really are losing our independence in a lot of things. I remember a fellow said to me one time, "Have you been back to Dublin recently?" And I said, "Well, I haven't actually." And he says, "Oh, geez," he says, "it's terrible." And I said, "Why is that?" He says, "Should the women are all wearing baseball caps, not shaving their legs and drinking Budweiser." So in a lot of things we have, especially the music, I think that we keep our independence in that. And I hope you'll enjoy your time here, and I hope you'll go and listen to some Irish music while you're here. Thanks for listening.